The Cosmos and the Bible, A Critical Examination of Modern Cosmological Theories, or alternative subtitle, Looking at Modern Cosmologies, by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract, a walking tour of the data concerning cosmology and how it constrains our theory-making regarding the origin and nature of the universe. Both Christian and secular models are surveyed, and a suggestion is made for a best model. What is cosmology? Well, we can characterize it this way. Cosmology is a study of the known parts of the universe to try to describe the whole universe. Cosmology is using the information now reaching Earth to reconstruct the entire history of the cosmos. These ways of describing cosmology suggest a little of its tentative nature, that you really have to be sure that the known parts of the universe are characteristic of the whole, and the information now reaching Earth is a characteristic of the entire history of the cosmos. Fortunately, there are some reasons to believe that there is something to this, namely that because of the finite speed of light, we're receiving some material from parts of the universe that go back to very early in its history and very far from us, and other parts that come from rather nearby and are quite recent. Our complication, of course, is that we can't look at the very far parts as it looks now, or the very near parts as they looked way back in history. The importance of cosmology philosophically, we could say it's one of the most basic questions we can ask. And yet, because of the tentativeness that we see there, Danish physicist Hans Alfvén thought it was a waste of time. And yet, cosmology is really too important to be ignored. But there's a large variety of cosmological models. It's something that people have a very big philosophical stake in, and so there's a great deal of variety out there. What's the importance of cosmology biblically? Well, the Bible tells us the universe is created, and so that would be of interest to see how that shows up in our in our studies. The Bible tells us its creator is a person, and that creator will one day call us to account for every thought and action. So getting cosmology right, at least in the big strokes, is a pretty important sort of thing. And the Bible also tells us, and this I think is quite important, that the Creator has embedded evidence in the cosmos that it is created. We'll look at a little bit of that in this talk, but a good deal more of it in several other of our PowerPoint talks here on the IBRI website. Importance of cosmology scientifically, it is one of the most basic questions of science, and we now have more evidence on which to build a cosmology than we ever have. This evidence comes from radio telescopes developed, initially before World War II, but then with a great help from the radar work that had been done through World War II, to put that on pretty strong footing afterwards. Artificial satellites, which have now been up since the late 50s, and then our understanding of nuclear and particle physics, which is largely the work of the late 20th century. And as we will suggest, the evidence points to a created cosmos. An overview of our talk here, we're going to be looking at scientific data relevant to cosmology. And as we go along at relevant points, we will be sticking in a remark about various cosmological models that come up in connection with that particular data. Some of these cosmological models will be those proposed by secular scientists. Some will be those proposed by Bible believers. At the end, we're going to try and pull things together and suggest a best model using both scientific and biblical data. So, let's jump in and get going. We start out with a very basic question that's pretty important, though. What are stars? Stars are, after all, the major thing that we see when we look at the sky at night, a clear night. And our answer to that is, stars are massive balls of gas held together by their own gravity, burning typically by nuclear fusion, and rather like our own sun. The temperatures of these stars are some thousands of degrees at the surface, and millions, or sometimes even billions, at the center. The heat of stars is produced by a nuclear reaction that is like that of a hydrogen bomb. The basic one that forms the main sequence stars is that of a conversion of hydrogen into helium. There's enough hydrogen in a star of the sun size to burn for about 10 billion years. A very basic question we can ask ourselves is, how do we know that the stars out there are really suns like our sun? And obviously, if we can measure their distances, that would be pretty important. And we can, for the 1,000 or even now 10,000 nearest stars, we can measure by a method called the parallax method. And in spite of that complicated name, it's a fairly simple method. We might call it the jumping finger method. If you hold up your finger and look at the wall or a window or something of that sort, and look at your finger first with one eye and then with the other, in other words, wink back and forth so that you're looking alternatively with one eye and then with the other, your finger will appear to jump across the wall or finger. And the reason is you're looking at your finger from two slightly different directions, and so they have slightly different backgrounds in those. Well, we can do something like that for the nearer stars. In this case, when we do it with the nearest stars, the distance is not the distance between our two eyes, which is only an inch or so, but it's the distance across the width of the Earth's orbit. The Earth is, 93 million miles from the sun, so the width of the Earth's orbit is about 186 million miles, twice 93 million. And if we take pictures of a particular star at right angles say, June and December, that star will appear to have moved slightly against its background, that is, if the star is near enough and such. We actually find out that, except for the sun, none of the other stars move very much. They all move under 1 second of arc. The angles are divided up into degrees, you're aware of, 90 degrees is a right angle and such. degrees are divided up into minutes, there are 60 minutes in a degree, and minutes are divided up into seconds, and there are 60 seconds in a minute, so there are 3,600 seconds in a degree, and all of the stars we can see have a jump of less than a second of arc. In fact, the distance represented by what we call a parallax second, a second shift taken from different sides of the Earth's orbit, is equal to a little over 3 light years, so 3 times 6 billion miles, and our nearest star is a little further than that. Well, once we've got the distances, the apparent brightness of objects, stars, sun, planets, etc., decreases with the square of their distances. And so now that we know distances to nearby stars, we can figure out their actual brightnesses, and we find out that those stars are typically as bright as the sun. That is, some are brighter, some are dimmer, but the sun is included within this range of the brightness of stars. We can actually also measure the masses of stars in those cases where two stars are rotating around each other. And when we do that, the masses of stars also cover a range which includes the sun. Now, it turns out that stars vary greatly in size, in mass, in color. The mass of a star can be as little as something under a hundredth of the size of the mass of our sun, and its mass can range up to about 100 times the mass of the sun. They vary substantially in color, which actually is a measure of the surface temperature of the star. To understand stars very well, it's important to think about what we call the main sequence stars, and this involves us looking at a diagram which has come to have the name the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, based on the two astronomers who did early work in this sort of thing. The picture we have here in our PowerPoint talk gives you kind of a artistic version of that, in which the color of the stars is actually shown graphically by color, and the size of the star is sketched for us by the different sizes of the dots, though giant stars can be a great deal bigger relative to regular-sized stars than these pictures here on this chart show us. And what we see is kind of an S-shaped line across the middle here that represents the main sequence stars, the stars that at their core are burning hydrogen to helium. And down to the right, we have the cooler red stars. So temperature goes down to the right and up to the left surface temperature. And if you look at the numbers down at the bottom, you may not be able to see them. We start at about 2,500 degrees Kelvin absolute. That's the Celsius scale, but starting at absolute zero. Run up to about 10,000 in the middle, and run up to above 40,000 at the left-hand side. And this is shown by the color star: red, orange, yellow, white, and blue. And that's the main sequence. When a star has burned up the hydrogen in the middle, in its center, the center will begin to collapse until it gets hot enough to burn helium into heavier elements. And when it does that, that produces an effect that makes the outer part of the star expand, and you get giant stars, such as you see above the main sequence. And we've got red giants over on the white, over on the right, and blue giants over on the left. When stars have burnt up all the accessible helium, all the accessible hydrogen they've got, even in the out towards the outer shells, those stars will then typically collapse. If they're small enough, they collapse into dwarf stars, which are those that are down below the main sequence. You can see white dwarfs down there is the label on that sort of material. And then they will gradually cool off and move to the right, etc., as they die off. If the stars are bigger than a certain size, they will collapse to neutron stars instead. And if they're still bigger, they will collapse to black holes. Well, that's the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Cooler to the right. Brighter is what's measured on the vertical scale there. Very bright stars at the top and dim stars at the bottom. Our sun is somewhere a little to the right of the middle on the main sequence here. Well, we take a little sidetrack here at this point to look at one cosmology that's been proposed by Harold Camping, the director of Family Radio. He argues for a miniature universe. He is responding to the problem that we can observe stars which appear to be millions of light years away, and even more. And so he basically then the argument would be, well, if we can see stars that are millions of light years away, that means light took millions of years to come from them, and the universe is millions or more years old. Camping argues, on the contrary, that the whole universe is only a few light years across, and so light only took a few years to come from the most distant stars. He does this by claiming basically that the stars that appear further away are actually just smaller and dimmer. He points out that our parallax or jumping finger method shows that the 1,000 nearest stars are closer, but really doesn't show us how far away the background stars are. And so he basically postulates that the background stars are only a few light years further away. He argues that all distance measurements used on the background stars, which we'll discuss here in a moment, are unreliable. Well, there are some huge problems for a miniature universe, even without getting into the question of whether the distance measurements to the background stars are reliable or not. Take binary stars, stars where you've got two stars going around one another. As those stars are moving in their orbit toward or away from us, we can actually measure their speed by looking at the red or blue shift in their spectrum, the same way that a police car bounces radar off of a speeder to see what speed he's going. We can do that without having to bounce anything off by using information on particular lines in the spectrum of the star. I'll come back and say more about that in a bit. And so we can compare the speed of the star in its orbit as it's coming towards or away from us from to the apparent size of the orbit and the length of time it takes for the binary stars to go around their orbit. The upshot of that is, unless we suppose that all the stars are moving much faster at the ends of their orbits than they are as they move across our field view that we've got approximately circular orbits on the average, and therefore we've got some order of magnitude for how far away these binary stars are, and they're way further than just a few light years for lots of those binary stars. Another problem is a kind of theoretical problem, but that is the dimmer stars that in Camping's view are the ones that are really small and such, not really very far away instead, that they would be too small to hold their hot gases. We can tell what their temperature is from their color, and a star that's that temperature but only has a mass, say, a thousandth of what it would if it's at the distance we think it is, that would be too small to hold its hot gases. We can also see when we look at star clusters out there that when we plot them in a Hertzsprung-type Russell diagram, they give the same sort of pattern as nearby stars, and this would be explained by the same mechanism, burning hydrogen to helium, etc., if these particular clusters are at great distances, whereas we have to invent some other total system if we imagine these star clusters are just little dinky stars nearby. A more recent problem for Mentor Universe has been the recent activity of a satellite called Hipparchos, a satellite that was put up above the Earth's atmosphere in order to do parallaxes on the various stars out there. Because it's above the distorting effects of the Earth's atmosphere, it's able to measure over 100 times further using parallax than previous observations have been able to, and therefore able to do the parallax on many, many more stars than before. And there are no signs of stars stopping beyond a few light years when we use the results from the Hipparchos satellite as well. So I think we can discard the idea that we live in a miniature universe, and that that's the way to avoid the problem that we live in an old universe, and it's taken many thousands, millions, even billions of years for light from various astronomical objects to reach us. We move on to think about galaxies. Galaxies are huge collections of stars, up to hundreds of billions of stars. We contrast them with star clusters, though in fact they aren't very big star clusters, because star clusters is typically the name astronomers give to groups of stars within a galaxy, whether they be the sort of clusters that our own star is in, or whether they be these big globular clusters that may have 10,000 stars or more. Galaxies are on a much bigger order than that, up to hundreds of billions of stars. Some of these galaxies, are shaped like pinwheels. We call them spiral galaxies. Perhaps 20% of the galaxies fall in that particular range. Most of the galaxies fall into categories that we call ellipticals, which are either spherical or football-shaped or M&M-shaped. Perhaps nearly 80% of the galaxies fall in this category. And then a few, just a percent or so, of the galaxies are rather shapeless, and we call those irregulars. Well, these galaxies appear to be at distances of millions to billions of light years, except for the particular galaxy we're in. How do we measure distances to galaxies? Well, we can't measure them by parallax because they're too far away, and even with getting above the Earth's atmosphere, the distance across the Earth's orbit, the 186 million miles, is not big enough to make any measurable change in the position of individual stars in other galaxies. The methods here are several which depend on comparing the apparent brightness of objects for which we have good reason to believe we know their actual brightness. And if you can compare the apparent brightness of an object to its actual brightness, then using the inverse square law, you can actually figure out how far away it is. Well, we can start, first of all, with main sequence stars, on which we have now a good deal of information from a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram and such, in which there's a strong relationship of the main sequence stars of their color to their actual brightness. And we can see that we can find stars that way out in the other galaxies as well, and they tell us that these galaxies are millions and even some billions of light years away. We can't see main sequence stars in galaxies billions of light years away, but we can see some of them in millions of light years away. We have another technique, and that involves variable stars. Variable stars are stars that get brighter and dimmer over a relatively short period of time. typically days or months. And one class of these we call Cepheid variables, based on the constellation Cepheus, in which one of these stars was found back many years ago. And there we find that the length of time it takes the star to go from bright to dim to bright again is related to its actual brightness. And so when we find Cepheid variable stars in some of the nearby galaxies, we can work out then how far those galaxies are away as well. A third technique, which is a little more speculative, is that of looking at the brightest stars in a galaxy, or the brightest globular clusters in a galaxy. We find evidence that these tend to have a fixed brightness, and so working from the actual brightness to the apparent brightness, we can get distances. And we see something of the same sort for the brightest galaxies in a galaxy cluster, and that carries us out very, very far for that sort of result as well. Well, some people, in seeking to avoid the idea of an old universe, have argued that, okay, our universe is not physically small, but it's optically small. We can't see any objects more than a rather short distance away. This idea was first proposed by a couple of secular scientists without any intention to support the idea of a young universe. Perry Moon and Dominus Spencer, in an article some years back, suggested that some features of Einstein's theory of relativity could be explained without recourse to his particular theory if light travels in circles of radius 5 light years. So their suggestion was perhaps the universe is just that we see is just a dozen stars within this distance of 5 light years, and there are multiple images, because after all there aren't many stars that are closer than 5 light years from us. Well, this view attracted very little interest in secular circles, but a great deal among young Earth creationists. It has, however, some biblical problems. The Bible indicates a great number of stars, like sand on the seashore, not just a few stars that we see multiple images of, and the context in which they occur. Look now into heaven and count the stars, if you're able to number them, etc., suggests that Abraham should be able to actually see a great number of stars that are stars, I suppose. This model doesn't solve the problem of light travel time in any case, because on this model, a star that appears to be 500 light years away, although the star might be very close by, the light that we see has traveled around these circles enough times that it's actually traveled 500 light years. And it's traveled for 500 years, huh? So, there are scientific problems as well. The view postulates that all the stars we see are just multiple images of the few stars within 10 light years. It's 5 light years in either direction from us. Huh? Well, that would be like multiple images in paired mirrors in a clothing store or paired mirrors in an amusement park. I was even in a hotel elevator once that had mirrors on three of the walls, and you could stand there and look at your image vanishing off, etc., try to take a picture of it even. Well, is that what we're really looking at? If you actually look at astronomical photos, you see that that idea is really quite absurd. We're looking here at a picture of the Hubble Deep Space image, and you can see the detailed structure of many galaxies out there and the different colors of the different stars and such. What you're seeing is way too much variety for a dozen stars multiply reflected, huh? You're seeing too many large objects with coherent structure, etc. You're not, in fact, looking at multiple images of a few stars within 10 light years, which would look very, very different than that. Well, we move on then beyond the galaxies to think about what we're seeing out there. In the course of looking at distant objects, looking at the galaxies, it was found that they have what we call galactic redshifts. In the 1920s, Besto Slipher and Edwin Hubble found that all but the closest galaxies have the light that's coming to us from them shifted to the red, and shifted by greater amounts the greater their distance. What do we mean by redshift? Well, when we look at light from a star, through passing it through a spectroscope, so it spreads out the frequencies or the wavelengths of the light into, so you get a red on one end and along across kind of a rainbow color thing, though not shaped like a rainbow. You find that from stars, this spectrum is not only this smooth change of light with color, but there are dark lines in the spectrum, and sometimes even bright lines in the spectrum, suggesting that light has either been absorbed at particular wavelengths or emitted rather specially at particular wavelengths. Redshift is a phenomenon that when you look at more and more distant galaxies, these dark or bright lines are moved over to redder color wavelengths than they are for the same lines that we detect in a laboratory on Earth, where burning various chemicals will produce these bright lines, and we can see exactly at what wavelength they occur. Where does this redshift come from? Well, there are various possibilities. One possibility is gravity redshift. We now know that light coming out of a gravity field is redshifted. The light is doing work in climbing out of the gravity field, and the stronger the gravity field is, the more the redshift there would be. We also know about motion redshift. That's the thing that's used in police radar. A police vehicle shoots a radar signal out at an automobile, and it bounces off the automobile. Suppose the automobile is coming towards the car, the police car, then the radar signal coming back is shifted to a higher frequency than it was. It's blue shifted, we would say. And if the car is going away from the police car, the frequency is shifted in a direction of redshift, if you like. The amount of the shift indicates the speed of the car. For objects out in the universe, we get both blue and red shifts for local stars and that sort of thing. But once we get beyond our local group of galaxies, the shifts are all red shifts. None of them are blue shifts, etc. We have, by the way, more experience, perhaps personally, with the redshift of sound waves from autos coming and going. It's pretty rare that an auto will beep its horn just as it passes you. But the noise from the tires and the engine, if you listen to that, you will notice that it's a higher pitch coming towards you and suddenly drops to lower pitch as it passes you. So, like that as it passes. That's exactly what you see. It shifts from a blue shift to a red shift as it goes by you because it's approaching as it comes up and then departing, going away as it goes off into the distance. How do we explain cosmic redshift? Well, we've got these alternatives, gravity and motion. Gravity redshift requires an enormous gravity field, and no reason why that should get bigger and bigger the further away you go, so really no explanation for that. Motion redshift has some strong implications as well. It implies the universe is expanding, as though from an explosion, though most cosmologists don't think it's an explosion, but that's how it got the name Big Bang. Most cosmologists think this is space expanding rather than the physical movement of galaxies. There have been other explanations given. One of them is a tired light explanation. Jean-Pierre Vigier and others have given this alternative to motion redshift. The idea here is that light is redshifted when it travels over long distances due to some unknown mechanism. Okay, so it hypothesizes an unknown mechanism. Well, there certainly are unknown mechanisms in our universe, but is that what's going on here? Well, unless you've got some other evidence, there's not going to be any strong move to go in that direction, not to say some people opt for that. So if you had a finite created universe, you might have some situation in which the redshift then would be due to traveling these long distances. We'll see why finite created universe later on here. But no other evidence for this, so it has never received very wide acceptance. Tired light problems. If you've got a static universe, so the redshift is due to tired light, then because gravity is attractive, how can a universe remain static rather than collapsing? The gravity would pull all the stuff in and it would collapse. If it's an eternal universe, stars don't burn forever. So how do you recycle the star's fuel to have an eternal universe? So although the tired light problem would be a way of resuscitating the old atheistic view of a infinite eternal universe that's, you know, not really doing anything, it runs into these big problems. In fact, if a universe is infinite in size and age, it violates what is known as Olber's paradox. What is Olber's paradox? What's the problem it raises? Well, Olber's, a couple of centuries ago, he wasn't the first person to notice this, but got his name attached to it. Olber's noticed that the sky is relatively dark at night. But he figured out that in an infinite eternal universe, the star should be the sky should be infinitely bright, or at least as bright as the sun's surface. How do you figure that? Well, imagine the universe divided up into spherical cells. We're just doing this, as a way of thinking about it. So we imagine we divide up the universe into spherical cells, shells centered on us, like layers of an onion. And if stars are reasonably uniform in distribution throughout the universe, then the number of stars in each shell, if the shells are the same thickness, is going to increase with the square of the distance, because the volume in a shell is its thickness times its surface area, and its surface area is 4 pi times its radius squared. And so the number of stars per shell increases with the square of the distance. But the apparent brightness of each star decreases with the square of the distance. So each shell should provide an equal amount of brightness, and the total in an infinite universe will be infinite. The reason you might have the sky only as bright as the surface of stars, that the stars will come to block this light from the stars behind them, etc. How do you solve Olber's paradox? Well, as one thinker has noticed, it's analogous to the question of how deep you have to go into the woods until you can't see light looking horizontally through the trees anymore. You can't see light from the clearings out beyond the end of the woods. It's analogous to the question of how deep one must go into the woods to see only tree trunks all around. Well, you basically have a three-dimensional version of that. To have a dark sky, the universe must not be deep enough to see only star surfaces in all directions. So if the universe is of finite age, then the universe will appear dark if you can see out beyond how far light can have come since the beginning of the universe. Or if the universe is of finite size, you can see out beyond the end of the universe. And there's a third possibility, the average star density is zero, which is a very obscure type of solution, which we will not do anything with here. But the current suggestion is that the universe is of both finite age and finite size, and therefore the sky appears dark at night. What we've mentioned twice here, attempts to avoid an old universe, one with Harold Camping of suggesting the universe is in fact very small, and another having these curved light travel paths. The third and perhaps more common suggestion is that we live in a young, created light universe. This is the most common young Earth view to avoid the problem of light travel time. The problem of light travel time stated quickly is this, that we see objects that appear to be thousands and millions and billions of light years away, and light traveling from them then would have taken thousands or millions or billions of years, and therefore the universe is billions of years old. Most common young Earth alternative to this is to claim, yes, the universe is very large, but it's only some 10,000 years old, give or take, you know, 6,000 to 20,000, something like that. Well, since most objects visible in large telescopes are more than 10,000 light years away, the light coming from them on a young Earth scheme of this sort must have been created on the way, so that when we look at an object that's 50,000 light years away, we're not actually seeing the object, we're seeing the light train from it that God created 10,000 years ago, and we're looking 10,000 years up that light train, but in fact, so we're seeing an image that never actually is based on the light that left the star. Well, problems with this. First of all, stars and galaxies are sending us a stream of information about their history. They're not just sending us light. In that light, we're getting information about their history. We're getting information about their temperature. We're getting information about their rotation. We're getting information about their movement. We're getting information about events on their surfaces, events in their whole collective set, and things of that sort. Stars and galaxies are sending us a stream of information about their history. For objects more than 10,000 light years away, on this young created light universe view, this history must be fictitious, telling us what the object would have been doing had it existed, but since it didn't, this is fictitious information. Given that God cannot lie, it seems to me that this view has more problems than an old universe view in which that light actually left those objects and has traveled all that distance. Another alternative to give a young universe, even in spite of the evidence we've got here, is the idea that the speed of light has changed. Barry Setterfield, an Australian Bible believer, has suggested, to avoid this problem, that the speed of light was infinite at creation and has recently settled down to its current value. The idea then would be that Adam and Eve could see the distant stars right away because the light took virtually no time to get there, and that the speed of light has been coming down since then. So therefore, there's no need to accuse God of giving us fictitious history. Well, there are problems with the changing speed of light as well. Einstein's equation, his very famous equation, E equals mc squared, measures the energy produced by nuclear reactions, among other things. And E is the energy produced. M is the mass of the material that is annihilated in the nuclear reaction. And a small amount of mass produces a lot of energy because C squared, C times C, is the speed of light squared. And the speed of light is a big number. Well, if humans existed when the speed of light was only 100 times larger than it is now, then C squared would have been 10,000 times larger. And so the sun burning a little bit of its mass would fry the Earth, okay? It'd be giving out 10,000 times more energy per unit time than it would if the speed of light was what it is now. Alternatively, if you say, well, God does something to keep E constant so that M was much smaller, then you can have say, well, okay, God causes mass of material burning in the sun to be much smaller. There's no reason to think that the physical laws would be inclined to do that. If you could say God defined the masses to be smaller, then the masses of air molecules would be too small to keep them on the Earth, and the masses of people molecules would be too small to keep them on the Earth. We have some huge problems in that direction. Besides that, we can actually observe transitions that take place. They're the lines in the spectra, and see that they have not changed so much as to have, because speed of light shows up in the equations for these, they have not changed so much for the speed of light to have been significantly different at any time in the past that we can actually see light from. Huge problem with this particular sort of thing. Well, we move on and talk about the isotropic radio background, or the 3-degree blackbody radiation of such. This was an observation that won a Nobel Prize for Penzias and Wilson. These two were engineers with General Electric, and they used this device that we see in the background of this picture, a huge microwave receiver. The horn was pointed in the sky, etc., and it noticed that at radio wavelength, the sky is not black at night or at daytime, but it's gray, that it's the same color, it's the same brightness all the time, day or night, etc., and very uniform in all directions and in all seasons as well. And the upshot of that was this is not something that is directional radiation, like the radiation of our sun, or something of that sort. This is something that apparently comes, therefore, from beyond our galaxy. Our solar system would have very different radiation in different directions. Our galaxy would have very different radiation in different directions toward the center, away from the center, etc. And it now appears that this is radiation that comes from the universe as a whole in some sense. A satellite was set up some years ago called the Cosmic Background Explorer, COBE, for acronym, that did observations of this radiation at different wavelengths, and the observation showed that the intensity of this radiation had a perfect fit to the radiation that would be calculated for a 2.7 degree black body. A black body is an object that gives off radiation and absorbs radiation, for that matter, only based on its temperature, and therefore there's a particular shape to black body radiation, which is the shape that we see here in this particular thing, kind of like a squashed bell curve, where it goes to zero at zero and then comes up to a peak and then goes down into a long tail, and that the complete shape of a black body spectrum is given by just one number, its temperature, the temperature of the object that's radiating, and it appears that the universe is radiating at 2.7 degrees absolute. Individual data points fit the predicted curve in a spectacular way. You can see that on this particular diagram looked at up close. What's the significance of it? Well, for one thing, it was predicted years in advance by George Gamow as a natural consequence of a Big Bang cosmology. In a Big Bang cosmology, this would be the glow from the time when the universe became transparent, about 100,000 years or so after its creation. Other cosmologies have no natural explanation for this phenomenon. Well, we'll come back to that later on. Quasars. Quasars are objects discovered in the 1960s that look like stars through optical telescopes. They're unusually bright when you look at them with radio telescopes, and they have enormous redshifts, most of them apparently being billions of light years away. Well, all through this time, we've had various cosmologies being proposed by secular authors to explain the large-scale shape and structure of the universe and its history and such. The steady-state cosmology was proposed in 1948 by three British cosmologists, Herman Bondy, Thomas Gold, and Fred Hoyle. And it takes account of the redshifts, universe expanding, and the finite lifespan of stars, and basically proposes, in order to preserve an infinite eternal universe, that is, a universe without a creator, that the universe is in a steady state. And this is seen to be a more satisfactory explanation philosophically than having to bring in a creator. The idea here is that the universe is constantly expanding, but new matter is popping into existence to keep the density of the universe constant. Problems for the steady-state cosmology? Well, it violates virtually all known conservation laws, conservation of energy, conservation of baryon number, things of that sort. but it does it on such a small scale that the cosmologists who proposed it said we wouldn't have been able to observe these violations at this point. But now, with the discovery of the three-degree black body radiation, etc., this particular model does not have a natural explanation for the isotropic radio radiation, and it does not have a natural explanation for evidence that the quasar density is higher earlier in the history of the universe than it is now. You see, a steady-state cosmology predicts that the universe looks about the same at all times and all directions over its history, whereas the competitor, which we'll look at in a moment, the Big Bang cosmology, proposes that the universe was much more dense and much hotter earlier in its history and has now become less dense and cooled off. That brings us to the Big Bang cosmology. It fits the observations of the expanding universe and stars of finite age. It predicts the isotropic radio radiation, giving its frequency dependence exactly, and earlier estimates of its temperature were in the ballpark. It fits the observation that quasars were more common early in the history of the universe. The upshot has been that the Big Bang cosmology is won out since the 70s or so, and now it's basically a fight between various varieties of the Big Bang cosmology. We can divide these up into basically three general ideas. The no-bounce version of the Big Bang cosmology, that our universe began in some sense at the Big Bang, that it did not exist before that. A one-bounce version, the universe is eternal. It was collapsing for the first half of its history and bounced once at the Big Bang and will now be expanding for the rest of its history. And the oscillating universe, oscillating Big Bang universe, an eternal universe bouncing every 100 billion years, which bounced at the last Big Bang event. The no-bounce Big Bang was proposed by the Belgian astronomer Georges Lemaître in the late 1920s. And basically, in this model, the universe has not always existed. It came into existence at the Big Bang event. And in the future, it might expand forever, or it might collapse back into a black hole. Lemaître didn't have all those variations worked out there, but those are kind of what you get. The one-bounce Big Bang was proposed by the Russian cosmologist Georges Gamow. The universe has always existed. Far back in the past, it was just a thin soup of hydrogen gas. It has gradually pulled together by gravity. It bounced at the Big Bang event, and since then, it has formed galaxies and planets and stars and life, and in the future, it will kind of just run out of gas. All will end with a whimper. You remember T.S. Eliot's end of his Wasteland. This is how the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Well, that's the one-bounce Big Bang. I don't know whether Eliot had that in mind or not. Oscillating Big Bang, as popularized by Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov, is also eternal, like Gamow's one-bounce universe, but you have a bounce every, say, 100 billion years, and the idea then would be that the universe expands, essentially runs out of gas, and the gravity pulls it back, and it collapses, and then bounces at the a Big Bang, and expands again, and so you have a bounce or Big Bang every 100 billion years. Some have proposed that perhaps each bounce changes the basic physical constants of the universe, giving a different type of universe each time around. In any case, for each cycle, the universe ends with a bang. The universe collapses on itself and becomes very hot and dense again. Problems for an oscillating Big Bang. Universe doesn't appear to have enough matter to collapse. That's been the case as early as there have been any attempts to measure the matter in the universe, and although other forms of matter have been found, we think we have dark matter and such, it still doesn't seem to have enough matter to collapse, and now recent observations suggest that the expansion is even speeding up. Even ignoring that problem, a contracting universe now appears would collapse into a black hole instead of bouncing. That's certainly not what you would want. And even if both of these things were not a problem, the question would be, would a universe be able to expand and contract without irreversible changes? Would not the universe become very different in the course of several cycles, etc.? Those are the problems, and those problems eventually led to the oscillating Big Bang being given up. Problems for a one-bounce Big Bang, it shares the problem of the bounce with the oscillating Big Bang. Won't it just collapse into a black hole? And you also have the problem of an infinitesimal rate of contraction early on, somehow producing a single universe-wide Big Bounce. The upshot has been that the no-bounce Big Bang has been favored. Most cosmologists for the past 10, 20 years now have been working with varieties of a no-bounce Big Bang, at least to the extent that our universe is finite in size and began with the Big Bang. Many are apparently hoping that our universe is just a subset of an infinite eternal universe. Ours is just a transient bubble which started back at the Big Bang and expanding. And that's kind of the standard atheist position today, if you like. But it's hard to see how to test something like that. How could you tell whether there's any universe outside our own? Well, summary of the scientific data. We still can't specify a single model, but the universe is very large. universe is very old, a finite age. The universe appears to be created. Some variety of the no-bounds Big Bang best fits the current data. Now I'm going to move rather quickly to the biblical data. What does the Bible have to say about our universe? Well, it suggests that the Bible pictures the universe as immeasurably large but finite. It says that the cosmos was created at a finite time in the past by the infinite personal God of the Bible, and it evidences his craftsmanship. And it pictures the universe as running down. Many see the Bible as picturing a young universe, and we will want to say something about that as well. Universe is immeasurably large. Look at these two passages. Jeremiah 33:22. I'll make the descendants of David as countless as the stars of the sky, as measureless as the sand of the seashore. That brings together a number of stars, sand of the seashore, etc. Still considered a good picture, if you like, of the number of stars in our universe, though it was made 3,000 years ago. Psalm 8:3-4. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? A common today to argue, how can God be concerned about man? Look how big the universe is. But that was already mentioned by David 3,000 years ago. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, what is man that you're mindful of him? Universe is finite. Psalm 147:4 says of God, he determines the number of the stars, calls them each by name. That's poetic. We don't know how hard to press poetic statements, etc. But determining a number, can God determine an infinite number? I suppose he could. Could he call an infinite number of stars each by name? Well, for them to have distinct names, they don't have to be infinitely long names, etc. Natural reading is it implies a finite universe. Universe is created, of course, is one of the big features of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Hebrews 11:3, by faith we understand the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what is visible. The universe is designed. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands, Psalm 19:1. Romans 1:20, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Universe running down. Listen to this one, Psalm 102. In the beginning, you, God, laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will remain, and they will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment. Like clothing, you will change them, and they will be discarded. So the universe is going to wear out like clothing wears out. Is the universe young? Well, that's the traditional understanding of the Bible. It's the main reason for the influence of the young earth creation movement among Bible believers. But the Bible doesn't actually teach the universe and the earth is young. The Bible does not say that the days of Genesis 1 are literal or consecutive. That's the simplest reading, but it doesn't say that, okay? The Bible does not say that the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11 should be added up to get a chronology. The Bible does not, in fact, add them up. And other places it shows gaps in the genealogies, etc. Is the universe old? Well, a universe billions of years old is not taught in the Bible either, but it does not disagree with a fair and reasonable interpretation of the biblical creation account. For that, see my arguments in Genesis 1 and the origin of the earth, and in the Zondervan three views on creation and evolution, plus the arguments of Hugh Ross in creation and time. Cosmos in the Bible. We've looked at scientific data relevant to cosmology. We've looked at various cosmological models, some proposed by secular scientists, some proposed by Bible believers. We propose a best model using both scientific and biblical data, and that is an old created universe, like what we actually see as both the biblical and the scientific picture. Well, that's where we're going to quit, and something for you to think about. We have other PowerPoint talks that look at some of these matters, and you might want to have a look at those as well.